You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Very warm welcome to all of you. Thank you all for coming. We're really pleased to have all of you with us today. I'm Rebecca Winthrop. I'm the director for the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings. We are very excited about the launch of our new report calling for a global compact on learning. And many of you, I see many faces in the audience who have participated and given vast amounts of input and feedback into the report itself. So thanks to all of those people who have collaborated and worked with us on this project. A special thanks to the Hewlett Foundation for their long and steady interest in improving learning around the world, and a particular thank you and recognition for the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, who have been very instrumental in this project in helping to catalyze a wide range of collaborative action on the issue. And today, the report that we're launching calls for, as I said, a global compact on learning. Learning, of course, is a lifelong process. It is not the same as testing. And we certainly believe here at the Center for Universal Education that it is a very important and central component of any educational process. We are grounded in the belief that all children have a right to a quality education, and that it really is not fair and it's not right that in many of the poorest countries in the world, and for many of the poorest children and young people around the world, they don't have access to quality learning opportunities. And those often who do make it to school are in schools that have such are perhaps lots of good intentions, but are not delivering quality learning, and kids are not being able to progress and are not making it onto secondary education. And if you're a poor girl living in rural Africa, or if you're a young male living in a conflict-affected country, or many other groups who are very marginalized, you deserve a right to a quality education. The report highlights that there's been huge progress in enrolling kids into school over the last decades, primarily primary school, which should be celebrated, but it's an unfinished agenda. Education is an unfinished agenda, and we need renewed attention. We need new energy, not only to meet the Millennium Development Goals by 2015 to get all kids into school, but most especially to ensure that we have a concerted focus on all working together to promote learning for all kids and young people around the world. And certainly on a personal note, as a mother of a young boy who's enrolling my child in school for the first time, something that my predecessor, Jean Sperling, would always say is ringing true to me quite a bit and is quite linked to this report, which is people only say that quality education or the quality of a child's education is really not important if it's not your child, if you're talking about other people's children, which is something we can't afford to do for many reasons. So it's a great pleasure for me to welcome our wonderful panelists and presenters. The way we're going to have the program today, Jenny Perlman Robinson, who's the author of the report and with the Center for Universal Education, will come up and will present some of the key findings and key messages. And then we'll have a discussion with a range of wonderful people. Oli Dibawada, who is the executive director of FAWE, which is the Forum for African Women Educationalists. She's based out of Nairobi. We have Dipali Khanna, who's the director for youth learning of the MasterCard Foundation. And we have Carol Bellamy, who's the chair of the Education for All Fast Track Initiative Board of Directors. So welcome to all of you, and thanks to everybody for coming. I think, Jenny, we turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca, and thanks, everyone, for being here today. We were a little concerned about holding an event in June that everyone would be gone for summer vacation, but thrilled to see that's not the case. I just want to echo Rebecca's thanks to those of you, and probably the majority of you in this room, who read countless drafts of this report and provided extensive input. You know, it's funny, the first thing that people say to me after looking at this report, after 80 pages, is not, what a shocking statistic, or what a moving quote, but it's, wow, a lot of people contributed to this document. And for me, I think that really speaks to both the strength of the report, but also a real show of the commitment that so many people have to this issue. So as Rebecca said, I'm going to speak for about 15 minutes or so and just share some of the highlights of this report, talking very briefly about the global learning crisis, how can we address it, and what specific action is needed. So over the past decade, we have seen remarkable progress in getting many more children into school, ensuring that they stay in school for longer periods of time, and narrowing the gap between girls and boys in enrollment, particularly at the primary level. But we know that these gains should not mask the enormity of the challenges ahead. There are still millions of children and young people who remain out of school, that progress has been highly uneven within and across countries, and oftentimes it's girls and children and young people affected by conflict that are the most excluded. It's estimated that 40% of children out of school today are living in countries that are affected by recovering from conflict. And last but certainly not least, for those who have been able to go to school, millions are leaving without the basic knowledge, skills, and competencies such as reading, writing, and math, critical thinking skills that they need to lead healthy, safe, and productive lives. And these challenges amount to nothing short than a global learning crisis, both for those who are out of school with limited ability to access learning opportunities, and for those who are in school and not learning the skills that they need for their futures. Thanks in large part to a number of civil society organizations and research studies and the efforts of ministries of education and others, there's emerging evidence on both the scope and the scale of this learning crisis. And I just want to share a few of these more staggering statistics with you. In some sub-Saharan African countries, children with 5 years of education still have a chance of, have a 40% chance of being illiterate. This crisis extends beyond Africa, where we see in rural India that only 53% of students in grade 5 could read at a second grade level. And far too many young people who are able to go to school and might very well be progressing on to secondary school are not learning the life and livelihood skills that they need for their current and future lives. Employers surveyed in 9 Arab countries found that only a third of their recent graduate hires actually had the skills needed to perform the jobs. Given the magnitude of this crisis, what we need is a paradigm shift to put learning front and center on the global education agenda. And this is for a number of important reasons, including that the right to education is not just the right to get your name on a roster or to sit in the classroom, but it's actually to learn something meaningful while there. That focusing on learning actually returns to the original intent of the Education for All goals. 164 nations met in 2000 and committed themselves to 6 education goals. Quality education was part of that commitment, and learning in particular. And it's been only through time that this agenda in some ways has really been reduced to focus more on access, and access in primary school in particular. There's also recent evidence that suggests that it's actually learning levels rather than just years in schools that drives many of the social and economic benefits we come to expect from education. For example, cognitive skills as measured by international test scores. Are strongly linked to increases in individual wages and economic growth, that literacy skills are strongly associated with reductions in fertility and improvement in child health outcomes. And lastly, in order to achieve universal primary completion and to reach our Millennium Development Goal number 2 by 2015, we must also pay attention to quality. Here we see some cross-country data that show a positive correlation between enrollment rates and average learning levels on the vertical axis. And at the same time, we know that a primary reason why children drop out of school or don't start school at all is because of poor quality. In many low-income countries, it's actually quite a rational decision that parents are making not to send their children to school when the costs are too great and the perceived returns on that education are too low. So it's much easier to stand up here and talk about a learning crisis, but more difficult to identify what it is exactly that we need to do about it. So over the past 6 months, the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings has undertaken a highly collaborative process to identify a new global agenda, one that could inspire collective action and use resources more effectively to reach this new goal of learning for all. You know, we often talk about in the education sector that we don't have a polio vaccine, that we don't have a malaria bed net, there's not a silver bullet, and not a one-size-fits-all approach. But recent research and on-the-ground experience do point to a set of priorities that have shown to contribute to learning outcomes across a wide range of countries. The report lays out this new policy agenda in much greater detail, but I'm just going to briefly go through some of the highlights. Each of the three priorities are supported by strategies and related actions. And I should say that this is by no means all that's needed. And it goes without saying as well that each of these actions must be adapted to the local context. The first priority is to help children get an early start on learning in life. That there's ample evidence that shows that what happens to children in early years has a significant impact on their development that persists well into adulthood. And so this requires expanding quality early childhood development programs, particularly to the most disadvantaged, who oftentimes have the most to gain from these programs. This includes health, nutrition, stimulation, good parenting. And secondly, to ensure that girls and boys start school at an appropriate age. In many low-income countries, it's not uncommon to see students in grade one ranging from 4 years old to 11 years old. And this, of course, not least of which poses a challenge to teachers to try to teach at such different developmental stages. And at the same time, studies show that children who enroll late are at much greater risk of repetition and dropout altogether. The second priority is to ensure that children are learning basic literacy and numeracy skills in the lower primary grades. And while these aren't the only skills that children need at a young age, they are absolutely critical for future learning. There are a number of actions that are required, but some of these include training teachers to teach an effective reading and math instruction, putting books in children's hands, and not just any books, but books at the appropriate level, and that teachers are also provided with the support and training on how to use them. Also ensuring that mother tongue-based multilingual education is available in the early years. This is particularly important as 50% of children who are out of school today don't speak the official language in their homes. And meanwhile, studies show that children who have access to instruction in their mother tongue are much more likely to enroll in school, to stay in school, and actually have a much better ability of learning the official language. The third priority is to equip young people with relevant life and livelihood skills. It's becoming increasingly clear that primary education is not enough, and that many of the economic and social benefits of education are accrued from continuing on beyond primary. And this is especially the case for girls and young women. So we have to ensure that more young people are transitioning on to secondary school or post-primary education, while at the same time addressing issues of relevancy and the applicability of what they're learning. This requires a number of actions, including reducing barriers that prevent young people to actually make that transition. And as we heard this morning from Ole at Fahway, oftentimes for young people who have completed primary school, it's actually an issue of the costs involved. There's also issues of safety and security and other factors that need to be addressed. For many young people in low-income countries, and in some cases a majority, they're actually still in primary school and not in secondary school or have dropped out of school altogether. So this requires attention to second-chance learning opportunities, giving young people the chance to catch up, to learn valuable school skills, to either enter or re-enter the formal school system, or to be able to participate in the workforce. And lastly, to strengthen the link between what young people are learning in their post-primary education and what the labor market opportunities are that exist. And this doesn't mean that young people should all be trained in a narrow vocation, but in fact that it's transferable skills that'll be important regardless of the future of a young person's that are important. Transferable skills such as communication, information communication technologies, financial literacy, and critical thinking. Progress on each of these three strategies also require attention to two additional progress on each of these three priorities also require attention to two additional strategies. One being the quality of teaching. We know without a doubt that teachers matter. It matters how they teach, how much time they're teaching. All of these have been shown to be powerful determinants on children's achievement. This requires attention to recruitment of teachers, particularly female teachers that are important for girls in many countries in particular, issues of deployment to marginalized and rural communities, support and training for teachers, motivation, different types of incentives as well. And secondly, we can't improve what we don't know isn't working. And this calls for simple, affordable assessment systems that provides useful and timely information at all levels, at the individual level, at the school level, at the systems level. And all of this is dependent on an enabling environment, an environment where there is attention to the most marginalized and disadvantaged, where community members, parents, teachers, students have an opportunity to participate in the learning process, where there's accountability, which requires just not access to information, but also the autonomy and authority to act on it. And lastly, and certainly not least, that you could have the best reforms take place, and none of that will matter if children are not learning in a safe and secure environment. So now that we have this new policy agenda, how do we now translate those words on paper into action? Well, the report calls for a new global compact on learning. And this global compact would bring together a wide range of actors to both catalyze and sustain collective efforts to address this learning crisis and ensure that children are learning relevant skills that they need. The global compact would renew international cooperation and redouble efforts, which is particularly important right now at a time when international support for education is waning. It would focus the dialogue squarely on learning, recognizing that the landscape has changed since the Millennium Development Goals were put into place, and that, in fact, new challenges need to be addressed, namely those of equity and quality. It would build on past successes and lessons learned, so not reinventing the wheel, and also leverage existing efforts that are going on to ensure that we're all pulling in the same direction. And lastly, it would be an opportunity to expand and enlarge actors involved, bringing in those outside of the education sector as well. We know the business of learning doesn't just involve those in education, and so we have to overcome some of those historical divides between sectors. So within this global compact, there's a role for everyone, but it also doesn't also presume that everyone will do everything. But in fact, different actors can champion different pieces as most relevant to their work. The Global Compact on Learning calls for specific actions for different sectors to take, again, which are further outlined, detailed in the report. But it also calls for all actors to come together and to work around six key areas. The first being leadership at the highest political level. So leaders of developing countries and developed countries, CEOs, heads of foundations and multilateral organizations, that everyone should be acting as a vocal champion for education and using their profile to put learning front and center on agendas, agendas of the G20, of the G8, of the African Union, ensuring that learning features prominently in the post-2015 global development agenda. Secondly, it requires partnership, that everyone is coming together and working together to achieve learning for all. And this includes a strengthened and reform education for all fast track initiative, which can serve as a centerpiece for international cooperation in education. Thirdly is the issue of financing. More resources are needed, but we also need resources used more effectively. And part of this can be achieved by aligning funding along the lines of the different priorities that are laid out in the policy agenda. We also, in order to make this shift from just focusing on access to access plus learning, we have to do a better job at measuring learning outcomes. And this requires disaggregated data by sex, age, ethnicity, other relevant characteristics, so we can track progress against existing disparities. We also have to ensure that the information collected is both timely and useful to inform both education policies and practices. One example is for the formation of policymaking tools such as national education accounts, where countries have a better idea of how much money is being spent on education, where exactly it's going, and how it's contributing to learning. Fifth issue is ensuring that the poorest children in the world have access to a quality education should really be one of the great public issues of our time. And yet to date, it's been seen that it's failed to capture the imagination of the public in a way that other critical development issues have. And it's not that there aren't exciting, important initiatives going on, that there are many different networks, organization, initiatives that are working on these issues, but we need to come together as a community and ensure that we're working in a coordinated collective fashion, that our messages aren't confusing at best or competing at worst, and that we're all pulling and then moving in the same direction. And lastly, building the evidence base. While some good data does exist, emerging evidence exists on what we need to do to improve learning, there's still a lot of questions that remain unanswered, and a lot of research gaps to be filled, some of which are identified in the report. So we need more attention, for example, more funding by donors, foundations, devoted to monitoring and evaluation, including rigorous and long-term studies, to really understand what contributes to better learning opportunities and outcomes, particularly for the poorest and most marginalized. So just to wrap up, we know that there's a learning crisis and it's widespread. We also know it's urgent to act, and failure to do so risks undermining many of the advances that we've made in education and in many ways in improving lives around the world. The good news is we know some of what to do, that we have a policy agenda that's been developed by a wide range of actors that highlights some of the key priorities and actions needed to contribute to this learning crisis, and that there's a role for everyone in this global compact. That we face a window of opportunity right now where there really seems to be this convergence of interest and energy on addressing learning, from grassroots organizations to donor education policies, and we really need to seize this opportunity with 4 years remaining to meet the Millennium Development Goals and the Education for All goals. The cost of not taking advantage of it is far too great. So we're calling for a global breakthrough whereby all actors are coming together and taking a different piece of this agenda and moving it forward. So why don't I conclude there? I'm going to turn it back over to Rebecca and our esteemed panelists to share with us a bit about what they're doing to address the learning crisis and what role they could see their sectors playing in this new global compact on learning.
Thank you very much, Jenny, for that overview. What we'll do now is just have a discussion with the panelists about sort of the report findings, about these issues, which of course are not brand new issues to people in the education sector, but one hopes that the report offers sort of new energy and a framework to try to collectively move together on them. What I'd like to do is ask all of you, Ole, Carol, and Dipali, you each represent different agencies, different organizations, you're coming from different perspectives. How do you see the learning crisis manifesting itself in your work? Is it as dire as, certainly the research that we've done tends to indicate? And maybe Carol, we can start with you. Thinking about, you are the chair of the board of the EFA Fast Track Initiative, which works with many, many different actors to try to support education plans in developing countries. You know, how do you see the learning crisis manifesting in FTI's work?
Well, I was thinking that it's a learning crisis, but it's an education crisis. And again, it's all been said. I'm going to be very repetitious, but there's such a lack of leadership in education right now, and it isn't on the global agenda. It's falling off the global agenda. A perception that, in fact, the MDG, and I was thinking we use all these letters, UPE and MDG, no wonder nobody understands what we're talking about. We don't talk to human beings. We talk to ourselves. And one of the things we have to do, and what I like about this report is it's actually understandable. It's actually written in language that, you know, your friends could understand, and they don't have to work in the development field. And so I think it's very important that we take something like this, take it even outside this room, because most of the people in this room are in the education field. Wonderful, but we have to take it outside. But, I mean, but more specifically, so it's the overall education crisis. More specifically, when it comes to learning, because so much attention has been on access and enrollment, and because in some ways MDG 2 was a dumbed-down education for all agenda, it took a lot of the robustness out of the education for all agenda. But on learning outcomes in FTI countries, we actually haven't collected the data, but there is data that indicates that in terms of reading outcomes in early grades in 27 FTI countries, only two are children even approaching international norms. Two out of 27 FTI countries at this point where they're approaching international norms in terms of learning outcomes. So certainly, while there are education plans, the emphasis in the education plan has been, again, much more around access because that has been the thrust and not so much in terms of learning outcomes. So that's a pretty drastic condemnation of a failure to be looking at education in terms of quality, but in such a more limited way.
Thanks. So it's real. That's a scary statistic, actually. Ole, what about you? You have run an agency, an NGO, that works across Africa, primarily focused on girls and, of course, poor girls, rural girls, not necessarily the more wealthy girls, really are at a disadvantage, at least the data says, in terms of quality learning opportunities. You know, how do you see this learning crisis in your work?
As I mentioned, thank you, Rebecca. As I mentioned earlier this morning, one of the key issues affecting the learning crisis is the dropout rates for girls. And a lot of factors contribute towards that, the economic, the social conflict, particularly in the country. And when I said this morning that out of 54 of these African countries, 20 are conflict, either in conflict or post-conflict countries. And when these girls do drop out of school as a result of either conflict or socioeconomic reasons, it's difficult for them to go back into school. And then for several reasons. Some of them, they fall pregnant, they married off very early. Sometimes parents don't see the value added because the learning, as stated in the report, going to school doesn't actually manifest itself into learning. And trying to justify the reason for them going into school, you know, the lack of quality teachers is an issue. So there are various issues that are affecting these girls, and we can't pick on one particular issue. A lot of it has, you know, you have to address all these key issues together to be able to ensure that, that we address the learning issues, in particularly for girls in Africa. Thank you.
Thanks. And Dipali, what about you? MasterCard works primarily in Africa, only in Africa, right? Primarily in Africa. particularly around youth issues, of course. How does this idea of a learning crisis, the way Jenny presented it, come to bear in how you're deciding on grantees and strategies, et cetera?
I think whatever Jenny has highlighted and what's there in the report is really what we're seeing in sub-Saharan Africa. We're definitely seeing a high rate of unemployment amongst youth. Youth who are graduating from the from secondary education, they are not finding the jobs. They're getting into the informal economies, which are not paying them. So there's a lot of issues around that. You talk to the private sector, there's a demand for skills, but the skills that they're looking for is not what these young people are actually getting from the secondary school system. So you're talking about skills that you were talking about, Jenny, around communication, critical thinking, ICT, etc. This is not what these young people are getting in the secondary education system. So there's really a need for us to really look at access issues to post-primary education. There's a need to really see the quality of education and how do you really make this transition for young people from school to higher education, to tertiary education, to workforce development. And also for some of them, there's no choice. They have to become entrepreneurs. So, you know, when you're looking at that space, how are you really giving them the financial skills, the ability to access capital, et cetera? So I think whatever has been said in the report is something we're experiencing day in and day out. And as you rightfully said, the call to act, it's really time for us to act and, you know, for us to get all the players around the table to really see how we can work in a coordinated manner, because this learning crisis is really real and we need to act now.
And Dipali, just a quick follow-up question. You mentioned this idea of, you know, kids who are graduating, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, from secondary school, and I know it certainly is the case from some of your work, that a lot of these kids need remedial education in order to even get a basic entry-level job. And what you talk about is often referred to by corporations as this idea of a talent gap, that there are jobs, particularly in the private sector. Companies want to employ African youth, but they don't have the skill sets in country to sort of staff up their companies. You know, do you interface with these? Because you talked a lot about sort of livelihood skills and formal economy, informal economy. Do you interface with these types of corporations or private sector employees? And what are you hearing from them, if anything, about this issue of the learning crisis? Yeah.
In fact, Rebecca, most of our investments are going in this area because we really want to see how the demand and the supply side really come together. So most of the work that we're supporting at the foundation, which is probably close to about $50 million in this particular area, through different partners, Education for Employment in Morocco, International Youth Foundation in Egypt. We have programs with International Labour Organization. We are working with Youth Build. So there's several organizations. And with all the work that we're doing through our partners, the starting point is really to start with the private sector and really see what are the kind of skills that they are looking for in the next, in the immediate horizon and the long-term horizon, and then going back to the so-called TVET centers or going back to the secondary education institutions and really having a conversation to see how you could really bridge the gap and what is needed to really get the kind of relevant skills that these young people need. And when we're talking about young people, we're really talking about disadvantaged young people. And so that's really the core of what we're trying to pursue within the foundation. And we're looking for innovative models that can be scaled up. And there have been some fair amount of success, and we're going to keep pursuing this track. But definitely, Rebecca, you're absolutely right. That's where we're focusing, you know.
And in fact, I think you already partially answered my second question to all of you, which is about what you all are doing to address this idea of, you know, Carol called it an education crisis, which is probably one way to talk about it outside of the education community, but what we're calling the learning crisis. You know, Ole, maybe with you, you've talked quite a bit in past presentations, and I've certainly heard this morning in a separate session about the wide range of areas of intervention that FAWE does around girls' education. Could you tell us a little bit about, you know, what are the types of strategies you're doing to improve learning for girls? And particularly, you know, one of the priorities that was mentioned or highlighted in the report is the big bang for the buck you get in early childhood development. Mm-hmm. You know, what does FAWE interface with early childhood? If so, what do you do?
For FAWE, we're looking at certain areas. Dipali had touched on some of the areas that FAWE is already working on. For example, we have the technical and vocational training programs, the TVET. And the TVET programs we're looking at is targeting young girls in conflict countries. And one area that we're looking at and taking on a study on that is looking at what happens to these young girls when we put them into these institutions, what happened to their children. Some of them, you know, drop out of school as a result of pregnancies, as a result of rape or early marriages, and bringing them back into the institutional training or building their skills and knowledges, what will we do with those children? How do we find a way of getting those kids whose parents are going back to school or going back into learning institutions and setting them up? And getting teachers, part of even looking at technical and vocational education training, getting teachers to learn in that process is also part of a TVET program that we could look in or build their capacity in that area. So TVET is one possibility of using as one of an entry point for ECD for these young children whose mothers, and we have re-entry policies again for girls who have dropped out of school and not allowed as a result of being pregnant or being married off early and wanting to go back into the education system. We've been able to convince quite a few government institutions to have enact re-entry policies. So we would be looking at that also as an entry point for early childhood development, but for those children whose mothers are going in. And we have mothers' clubs as well, so the income-generating activities, we could use these mothers within these communities and start training and getting teachers involved in those areas. So we have at least three or four opportunities that ECD can come in. Thank you.
And one of the things that struck me in terms of this idea of a reentry policy, I'm curious to hear a little bit more about that. How effective have they been? Mm-hmm. Has it really enabled young women, perhaps who've dropped out, perhaps with young children of their own, to come back into the education system? One of the things that, you know, we certainly found in the data and the report highlights is, this idea of late entry into school. So if kids start school a bit late, not a couple years late, they enter primary school, say at age 8 or something. Girls particularly are affected by this because they start late and then they're squished in terms of they have very few years to complete primary at least because of early marriage norms and various other things that make them drop out more during adolescence. Mm-hmm. And so in a way are squished between the late entry and early marriage. Mm-hmm. So is the policy change of reentry, is that actually effective in bringing them back, or is it more of a social norm that needs to be changed?
A bit of both, but I think what has happened is when these girls are given a second opportunity, they become more motivated, they become more determined. One example is one of the girls that we have in Sierra Leone, and she got pregnant, she had an opportunity to come back. Her mother was prepared to help keep an eye on and she is so determined. She's become a model for saying, I must make it. I must, you know, show that I prove that I can do it. So I think that giving a second chance or a second opportunity does help to motivate that there is actually light at the end of the tunnel. So it is working. It helps. Thank you.
Carol, what about you? You know, FTI does a lot of work in a lot of countries through its partnership model. I'd be particularly curious to hear the types of things that FDI is doing, I know across the board, but particularly on this idea of improving literacy and numeracy skills in lower primary grades.
Well, again, just a reminder, when FTI was launched, 8 or 9 years ago, it was specifically around MDG 2, Millennium Development Goal 2, which was access and completion of primary. But over the years, it's become clear, certainly to the board and certainly from the Secretariat's perspective and certainly from the country's perspective, that as you pointed out, as you just mentioned again, and as the report points out, you don't even get full benefit of primary without secondary. So the scope is expanded to include all education for all. So that first of all, the education sector plans now don't have to pretend that they're only about primary school. You had ministers trying to pour a broader education sector plan into the little bottle called primary school. And so it can include ECD, early childhood development, although I think, to me, ECD starts in the womb, and I think too much of ECD is seen after the most crucial period, which are the first 3 years, when it's really still in the family. And it includes other things, literacy and numeracy. But a couple of the very specific things that FTI will be doing going forward is in the context, certainly, of the earliest years in school, is, in addition to the expanded scope, is the implementation in the context of these education sector plans of a results framework. And that results framework now will track a range of indicators. In fact, it started to do that in terms of education plans. A couple of the indicators are the proportion of students who are reading after the first 2 years. So that's right in the beginning. And then another indicator will be the proportion of students reading at the end of the primary cycle. And another indicator will be the, and in fact, there are a range of indicators, will be instructional time, because we know that there's a limit on instructional time. We'll also be looking at, and we know that what tends to happen is the best teachers are assigned to the higher grades rather than the best teachers in the earlier grades, which is really where you want the best teachers. So that's another indicator that will be part of this results framework that will be put into place. We'll also be looking at mother tongue, although, again, there are challenges to all of these things. I was talking to the, I think, vice minister in Mozambique, who said that they adopted the policy of doing mother tongue, but they then didn't have enough teachers who could teach the mother tongue. And then the question is, how many different mother tongues or local languages are there in a country? If it's a single one, like Rwanda, you might be able to do it, but if it's multiple in another country, you're not able to. But in any case, in terms of FTI going forward as of now, this results framework, which is now going to be put in place in terms of all the 44 countries, we will be actually looking at these indicators specifically focused on the early years.
Thanks. And Dipali, you started to answer my question before I asked it. No, I think I asked you a follow-up question that led to that. But, you know, you want to tell us a little bit about how you see MasterCard addressing some of these issues?
At MasterCard, we're really focusing on the post-primary because we do feel that, at least when we started looking at the whole area of youth learning 2 years ago, we did feel that people were talking a lot about primary education and basic education, but nobody was really talking enough about post-primary education. So that's really what the focus of the foundation has been. And within that, we're really focusing on three thematic areas. We're focusing on continued learning, which is really about providing access and quality learning at the secondary education level. The second thematic area where we're focusing is the connecting to markets, where we're really looking at the demand side of things and really getting the relevant skills to young people. The third area is supporting entrepreneurship. And as I said, you know, the whole root cause of the issue right now as we look at the whole learning crisis is that the assumption is that the kids are going to complete primary education. How can we at the foundation support them to make that transition into post-primary, which is going to be relevant, meaningful, is going to bring about the results that at the end of the day we want these young people to be productively engaged in all that they're doing, living with dignity. So if that's really where we want to be, how do we address all the issues that go around the young person making a transition at a social level, at economic level, and the whole support from within the community, the protective mechanisms that these young people need. So that's really what we're looking at, and that's where we're going to be spending all our energies over the next few years at least.
Great. Thanks. And then the final question to all of you before we open it up and have a discussion with folks here is, you know, it's very easy for us as Brookings. We do research. Many of you have participated in this particular report. We put out recommendations. We have a call for a global compact on learning, which, you know, in our think tank bubble, we hope can help galvanize a whole wide range of actors to, you know, work better together, a broader framework which can help particularly speak outside the education community and raise education on the global priority agenda. And then we don't have to necessarily do any of it because we are a think tank. We're not operational. We don't fund things. We don't implement, et cetera. We're busy. I guarantee you we're not sitting around all day doing nothing, twiddling our thumbs. But, a question for all three of you who are very much engaged in the operational making things happen in the education world, how realistic is this Global Compact on Learning idea? Do you think it really can serve to galvanize a wide range of actors? So not that everyone's doing the same thing, but at least we're working much better together and having a few core messages and complementing each other's work. Carol, maybe we'll start with you because, you have a great purview at FTI, but also you have quite a bit of experience running UNICEF and various other agencies in this type of sort of agenda setting work. What do you think? And realistic opportunities that we should seize upon, big challenges we haven't thought of?
Well, I actually think the we is the broad we, have learned a lot. 4 years to go to 2015, we all know we're not going to meet a lot of the goals, but I think we've really learned a lot. And there's some really good lessons out there and some good practices. And there have been a lot of good actors out there. And there are examples. And we know what should be done in a lot of cases. At least... it's the drumbeat about learning now is getting louder and louder, and that's good. This report is another very strong, it isn't just a report that says do something, it offers some suggestions about what to do. We're working better together. We could all work a little bit better than we are working together, but I think that's even improved. I think the consensus is really built now around learning, which really took a while. I mean, it's been 20 years. It's all been focused on access. And it's really only recently, if we put it in the context, that the idea is, well, access is great, except they're not learning anything. So I think there are examples out there. We can build on work of a lot of, the new USAID policies, the work that DFID has done, this work. FTI is not about implementing. It is about a partnership, and it's building, and it's the robustness of that partnership. And that partnership has to start with the ownership in countries themselves. And so, again, it's leadership plays a critical role, and we are really missing that leadership right now. But I think in terms of what to do, we know a lot better now what to do and how to do it, and we have to get about doing it. I think your emphasis on information and data and monitoring and sharing that is critical. I think we've had uninformed actions, and we now can be better informed in terms of action. So it really is accelerating. It is working closer together. It's sharing information. And we can do that better, and we just need to get about doing it.
Dipali, what about your thoughts? I'm particularly interested to hear from a foundation perspective. Just to give one example, in the U.S. philanthropic foundation giving, education in developing countries gets very little versus health in developing countries, which I think gets roughly half the sort of financial support for international giving, and education gets 5% or around there of international giving for foundations. Now, MasterCard is a Canadian foundation, but to me it just highlights the need for greater leadership, more investment from private sector actors, including foundations.
I think this report has really got the wider community within the foundation world and the private sector together. We do have an international education funders group, which is looking at this report and the outcomes of this report very, very seriously. In fact, they've been part and parcel, quite a few of them, as this was being developed. So I think whatever is being said in terms of the actions that are needed, there is alignment. And I'm hoping that, you know, the Education Funders Group would be really working together so that, you know, we really are going to be making the right investments so that we can see the results that we really need to see. And what Carol said, which is really important, you know, in terms of the monitoring evaluation systems, you know, what are we learning? How do we don't keep, how are we learning from our mistakes or how are we learning from our successes? It's critical because I think all of us are trying to make a dent, but, you know, we're not sharing enough. We're not kind of informing each other about what's happening. So the International Education Funders Group is one such group, which definitely is going to help us to get together. The second being within the FTI now that the private sector and the foundations do have a seat on the board, and we have Lynn from Hewlett who's representing us, there is going to be a lot more alignment. There's going to be a lot more coordination because I do think in the past, within our world as well, there's been quite a bit that's been happening, but, you know, we haven't necessarily been keeping each other informed. So there is going to be more of like-minded minds coming together, seeing what's working, what's not working, engaging a lot more with civil society, engaging more at national level, regional level, to really see what should be our priorities, how can we align what each of us has been doing in the past, what can we build on. So I'm really hoping and I'm quite confident, and that's why the MasterCard Foundation has been involved in this journey over the last 6-9 months, even though we've been in Canada and haven't been able to be part of most of the discussions that have been happening here. But over the phone, there is a lot of commitment and there's a lot of support in making this happen. And thank you so much for doing this excellent piece of work. I think this report is really something we're all very proud of being a part of. So,
thank you. Thank you, Dipali. So, Ole, what about you? You interface with ministers of education in Africa on a daily basis, and ultimately, at the end of the day, governments in developing countries have to take this agenda on. There's absolutely going to be no other way. They are the key actors to champion this if this type of change is going to happen. What do you think? Is it feasible? What are the big challenges out there, opportunity?
I think there is there's already an awareness on the importance of it. I think the report, we have all contributed, and the key actors that have played a role in this know what the issues are. And that has been reflected in the report. I think for FAWE, one of our strengths is that we are one of key organizations that work specifically with the ministries of education. And over the years that we have been, since we established, we've built that trust. We are not seen as a threat. Usually civil society and government organizations see themselves as conflicting or they see themselves as threats. And we've established a trust, that trust with them. We sign memorandums of understanding. So the key issues that are on the ground, we are key actors on the ground on these issues, and we have a platform that we can share some of these learnings and highlight the key issues. And I think what is important is that we come together and have a common voice, and we've been walking the talk, and we need to continue walking the talk and hammering it in. And I think they're aware of it, but we need to continue to hammer it. And the opportunity that we have as FAWE sitting in quite a few and platforms and forums, the report is a key strategy for us to use to share in those audiences. I've already started doing that anyway. So thank you.
Great. Thanks to everybody. I think we have a little over half an hour to open it up to discussions. Discussion, questions. So why don't we take several questions at a time? Are there people who have questions? Let's take a group. 1, 2, 3, 4. No, go ahead. Start there. Yeah. No. I'm sorry. The gentleman in the back with the lovely floral. It's not quite floral, but... Yeah.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Mr. Lloyd. I'm a public school teacher from Maryland. Two of our speakers made emphasis on the mother language and linguistics as a good tool for communication and improving kids' performance in education. Now, the concept of mathematics and science are basically English, and we're using terms like gravity, square root, cube root, kinetic energy, all in the English language. Now, how can we make these terms and all other scientific terms and mathematical terms very simple for the kids so that they can understand more of the concepts and not on the language per se. Now, if we had to translate that in different kind of languages, like Chinese, Japanese, Swahili, or Spanish, whatever, I'm sure this would create some sort of some confusion. And the commonality of this is that we have English for kinetic energy and English for cube root and all of these things. So how can we make these things very simple for children to understand the concepts and not just the language? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Right here, and then not you, Steve, yet. Yes, you. Yes, the green scarf, yes.
Hi, my name is Sonia Michelle. I'm director of U.S. Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. But several of the speakers mentioned the need to link education to other realms of policy, and one of the things that I've been working on is immigration and understanding that women now comprise at least half of worldwide immigration, and often these women are mothers. So I'm just wondering what impact the absence of mothers of these young children has on their actually attending school, going to school, and so forth. Ollie mentioned mothers' clubs. I wonder if there are other initiatives like that and whether the absence of mothers is actually interfering with these development goals.
Thank you. Steve Cleese from the University of Maryland. I think it's a very important report, and I think it is important that we move together much more than we have. I have a comment and a question. My comment is, in terms of learning, I hear a little bit of a move beyond basic literacy and numeracy, but I don't see it taken seriously. Beyond math and language, we want our children to be critical thinkers, to do higher order thinking, teamwork, cooperation, solidarity, peace, tolerance, humility, curiosity, courage, resilience, democracy, citizenship. I could go on, but I elaborate a list like this because we don't do literacy and numeracy alone. And we need to pay attention to these other issues, or else learning for all becomes testing for all. And it just tests for literacy and numeracy, and we spout something like critical thinking as one additional area. We need to think about what our children learn. That's my comment. And my question is, I think there's something to be said for all of us trying to move together in the same direction, was the way it was said. But even with the research we have, and we have lots of research out there, there is major debate about even things like how best to teach reading, but debate about what educational outcomes are important, about what skills are important for jobs, about what education is needed for citizenship, about governance, about public versus private. And I wanted to know, to what extent have you thought about how to bring debate centrally into this compact? Thank you.
Great question. And one more in the middle on this side at the back. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm Anju Malhotra from the International Center for Research on Women. I had a question and a comment. My question was, I wanted to congratulate you for a wonderful report, and I really appreciate the emphasis on solutions in terms of the strategies laid out, and that's great. But I have been wondering whether you have some thoughts on why it is that we are where we are. Why is it that education, which was seen as the magic bullet for development, is not on the agenda in the way we would all like it to be? And I was wondering whether Carol's comment about, you know, the second MDG being dumbed down is perhaps it's worth thinking whether that was actually a bad strategy, whether that actually led to sort of this false sense of achievement that that isn't there. Or is it that we haven't been really looking at the macro level enough? I mean, if we look at the East Asian successful economies in terms of health and development, why is it that those countries realized that investment in education was going to lead to success? And why is it that countries currently are not realizing that? Are we not following that model anymore? What happened? Where did we abandon that kind of investment? And is it possibly that we have too many failed states now? And to Rebecca's point that states have to take this on, governments have to take it on, I'm actually wondering whether it is realistic to think that governments will now take this on in the way that they need to, and really private sector investments in very different models, given that we are in a global economy, that private sector will have to do actually what private sector has been doing all along. You know, the governments bring students up to a certain point, and then private sector gives them the training once it absorbs them in the job pool. We're finding that, you know, working with Gap, for example, we're helping them develop training models for garment workers in factories that can be scaled up, and it's really now becoming a private sector initiative if it's going to have the talent pool that Dipali thinks that, you know, it needs. So just, you know, one question about the reasons for why we are there, the macro level reasons, and whether it really is going to be in this global economy more of a private sector. And I'm not saying that governments won't play a role, but much more of a private sector role.
Okay, thanks. Jenny, why don't we start with you? Maybe not every last question, but some of the questions you feel comfortable asking, and particularly I think the question that Steve brought up about, because you did author the report and you did saw firsthand the debates that were there, but that's very interesting, I think, idea of how do you bring debate into the process?
Great. I guess just very briefly to first respond to a school teacher from Maryland. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. I can't answer all of the challenges and practical strengths around mother tongue-based multilingual education. And in fact, I know we have some experts here in the audience. But in fact, the research that I've seen talks about ensuring access to mother tongue language in the early years, and that then the ability to transition either to the official language or to bilingual education when the curriculum gets more sophisticated, as you mentioned. Again, that's not to say that even in the early years isn't without its practical constraints. But again, the research shows that where there are costs involved, the startup costs, the savings that are accrued later on significantly outweigh those initial costs. It's more expensive, obviously, to have kids dropping out of school or not learning in school, and some examples around the world there. On Steve's point, very well taken about we need to ensure that we're not just focusing only on literacy and numeracy. You could see maybe some of the same mistakes being made, and 10 years from now we're having a similar discussion talking about how we reduce the agenda to a particular issues. So I think that's well taken, and I think the report does make the point that these are not the only skills, but they've shown to be the basic fundamental building blocks for some of these higher order skills. That being said, critical thinking, for example, other life skills that you mentioned, analytical skills, are absolutely fundamental, and I think there's some good examples and models out there, but a lot that we just don't know and that we might not have the same evidence base that we have in other areas. And so that's where the Global Compact, for example, would call for more research and more discussion and more scaling up these models. The annual survey on education report, ASSER in India, has just recently included a question in their annual survey that gets to the issue of critical thinking skills. So examples like that that we can learn from so that it is not just about literacy and numeracy, as you said. On bringing debate into the Global Compact, I think I was remiss by not saying that I think the overall intention of the Global Compact, as I said, is to catalyze and sustain collective action, but it's also to stimulate debate and conversation. That I can definitely attest to the fact that there are a wide variety of opinions about how to teach one's child, from my mother's group in Dumbo, Brooklyn, to the many of you that I converse with on the phone and talk about education globally. So we need the space and the room for that conversation, and I think we need to ensure that that remains front and center in the Global Compact. And just very briefly, I don't want to take up too much time, on Anju's point about why we're here, I would be very interested to hear from the panelists on that question. I would just briefly say that first, I don't want to forget that there has been great success in getting kids into school. In fact, people claim the Millennium Development Goal number 2 is the closest to being met. So I think that shows that when you do unite, come together, have collective action, that we can see achievement, we can see movement. And I think that's sort of a rallying cry for us to ensure that we might not have one comprehensive agenda that everyone can sign up to, but at least we're doing a better job as an education community and involving the many other communities to ensure that we are united and speaking much more with one voice. And lastly, on the conflict piece, I think you're absolutely right, Anju, that it's only been recently that conflict has been brought into the fold of education, that it hasn't been part of the education development conversation. You know, conflict's a humanitarian issue. We don't deal with conflict. And then on the humanitarian side, education's a development issue. So we don't talk about education. We talk about life-saving interventions. And so I think we're now finding ourselves at the point where Ole said, where in many cases, a vast majority, at least not a significant number of those out of school, are in these very countries that have sort of fallen through the cracks through the years.
Carol, what about you? Especially maybe any question you want to answer, but especially the why are we here question.
Well, I do think there are mixed signals, as was just pointed out. In fact, we suffer from a perception of success in some ways. The point, which has been made several times, which is the perception is among the Millennium Development Goals. And remember, that's a political agenda. The EFA was largely an educational agenda. I'm not judging either of them, but they are actually quite different and from different audiences or different constituencies, if you will. But the perception is that there has been success in what was the goal, and the goal was access, and it really is only recently. I'm not as optimistic as you are about the fact that we're now recognizing we are recognizing that a large number of out-of-school children, this doesn't get to the quality issue yet, but out-of-school children are in conflict or post-conflict. But the issue of whether education is being taken seriously in the humanitarian context is still a very difficult one. The humanitarian departments of donors are on the seventh floor, and the development departments are on the second floor, and they never talk to each other, whereas health has always been seen as both an emergency and a development issue. Education has not been. There's talk about it, but it's still the least funded of any of the areas in terms of humanitarian. So it's nice to say, let's take into account fragile states and post-conflict, but it's still wait till things calm down and it's quiet and you're just poor, and then we'll deal with education, rather than recognizing that, in fact, the best thing you can do for a child in a crisis is to try and bring some kind of normalcy into this abnormal situation, and education or some kind of learning is something that can take place. I just wanted one question on quality. Quality does clearly go beyond learning outcomes. It includes as well how well the school functions as a center of community life, but you got to start somewhere. And starting somewhere with concrete issues in the earliest years around specific things will at least allow some, frankly, learning about learning to help influence the broader agenda. And so it isn't that one isn't concerned about quality more broadly, but you got to start somewhere, make a difference somewhere, and that can help shape the broader agenda. Other conflicts in education are the fact that, talking about ownership, recent study out of the UNESCO statistics showing that in something like 20 sub-Saharan African countries, an increase in investment in education to the tune of 6% annually over the last decade, recognizing that it is the largest portion of domestic budgets. So every external dollar or kroner or yen or pound or whatever comes in is much more highly leveraged in education than it is in health, and yet it doesn't happen. So you have these conflicts. You have success, and yet the success is around access. You don't have immediacy in education. You can't just, you know, jab a kid and say that kid is educated and take the picture because it takes some time. So all of these things make it a little bit more of a challenge. But that's, we're up to that challenge.
Carol, can I actually just ask you a follow-up on Anju's last question? Where do you see this question of why are we here and what to do about it? Where sort of what's your vision for FTI? You just had a board meeting in terms of their role. I mean, the report talks a lot about FTI, calling for, you know, rebranding, empowered secretariat, et cetera. Where's that heading?
Well, again, FTI is about the partnership. It's not about FTI. It is about the partnership, and that is a partnership of developing countries, donor countries, civil society, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I forgot to mention, but civil society plays a really important role, including teachers. It is about the private sector and private foundations. It's about the broad partnership and who can contribute. It's about not only ministers of education, but ministers of finance, who very often have more to say about education than the minister of education. So it's about the energy of the community coming around. FTI supports it, so it has to do things. I don't mean we're sitting back not doing something, but it isn't ultimately a separate implementing. It is about strengthening education. It's about your circle that said everybody has something to contribute. It may be different ways of contributing it. It may be financing. It may be technical assistance. It may be capacity building. It may be policy dialogue. And so the FTI got started and kind of then became seen really as a funding source. I always said if we're just a funding source, we can have three little chubby accountants sending checks. We need to be
can
more
they be
energized.
Skinny accountants?
All right, skinny accountants. So, yeah, spoken by a lawyer. What do you think I think about accountants? I love them. They're wonderful. What it should be about, I hope, is really helping to put that energy back into this broader partnership. And I must say, I know governance is really boring, but we had our first revised governance, which really we were called upon, FDI was called upon, to assure a stronger voice from the partner countries, the countries where things are happening. And that's starting to occur. And I think that the more we see the leadership from the countries where the challenges are the greatest, other actors will have more enthusiasm, I think, because they're going to see that kind of leadership. So, one, I do think the FTI has an important role, not to be the only one, but to help make sure that all the actors are at least heading in the same direction toward the same goalposts. It's more like a football game. Not American football, the real football game. People can be at different parts on the field, but all heading for the same same goal. And so I think that's a role that the FTI can play. So it does need to have a secretariat that has a range of skills. It does have to have a name that doesn't make, as my friends in New York think, I work for the FBI. It has to have a name that has something to do with education. But it is really it's one and one is eight. It's not the FTI itself doing it, but it's the FTI helping to be supporting the range of actors that are involved in it.
Just one thing that I'd like to say is that as the report was being developed, we from the foundation were wanting to try and get a sense from young people, what were they thinking, particularly since our focus is post-primary education. And again, going back to Steve, what you were saying, they were wanting to get more about ethical leadership because, again, our focus being sub-Saharan Africa, you know, governance issues, et cetera. So, yes, young people do want all these additional skills. And also going back, Anju, to the point that you were making, I mean, it's good that GAP is investing, you know, private sector is coming forward and providing these skills. But again, the choice is not with the young person. They're really at the mercy of, you know, what's out there. So within the post-primary education, how can we give them the kind of skills which are transferable for them to be in a position where they are able to make the right choices? And then, you know, if they need additional skills, and that can come at a later stage. So I think I just wanted to share that with the group.
Thank you. I think talking about the issue of education migration and getting mothers involved, I mean, for FAWE, being an organization that is spearheaded by African and women, for that matter, I think that's one key area that we keep looking at and we continue to work on that. This whole process of learning and falling down and standing up again and walking again is a process. It's a learning process and it's a long-term process. So we keep learning and each time we try to improve on that. So as we have the Mothers Club, we have women as part of the school management committees. These are areas that we're working on, and we're open to more improvements and working on that. I think it answered also to the question on why are we here and why are we where we are. For me, I see us going back to when we started with the whole issues of structural adjustments. There was a priority issue, then you deprioritize, and then education doesn't become a priority anymore. You cut down on quality teachers, on health, and then you focus on something else. And then we come back, we start improving on it, and then it comes back again and deprioritized again. So we keep just going up and down we're like a yo-yo, just keep going up and down, and we need to put our foot down and say, this has to stop. This is about people's lives. We can't be playing when somebody wakes up in the morning and has a bright idea and we all jump at it. So for me, that's the key issue. Thank you.
Let's take a few more questions. There's one here in the middle. We'll take several at a time and then just do a quick wrap-up.
Thank you. This is May Rihani from AED. Thanks for the panelists and thanks for the report. Very enriching. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that there is a healthy tension, I think, between the fact that we always, which is normal, want to prioritize. It's absolutely normal because we think that's more effective and efficient to be able to prioritize. And I think the healthy tension is between that and the fact that education is a continuum. It starts with early childhood and it continues primary, secondary, and post-secondary, either to tertiary or to the labor force. And prioritizing might make us fall back into what Carol called dumbing down. We do only one thing or two things, or one of the MDG goals focused on access, and we forgot that it's about access and quality. It's about access and quality and learning and results. So how do we reconcile all of that? That it is about prioritizing, but it's also about this continuum from early childhood development to the labor force. And I think Dipali raised an issue by saying, what are the skills that we need for the labor force? And I think they start very early. They start with reading and arithmetic and math. This whole issue about critical thinking, this whole list that Steve talked about, starts very early. We call it sometimes life skills. We call it many things. But it starts at very early. It continues through primary. It continues through secondary. It develops. It becomes more sophisticated at the higher levels to be able to reach education for what? And that's the education for what could be the whole livelihood, could be being a productive citizen, being a citizen, a responsible citizen, and a productive citizen. So if you have some comments about that healthy tension between prioritizing and that continuum and the need for all of this. I'll give one small example from our research in Morocco. And our research in Morocco told us that if the parents know there is a secondary school, and if the secondary school teaches relevant skills that the family benefits from, then they'll keep the boys and girls in school. Specifically, the girls would suffer if the parents don't know there is a secondary school and it teaches relevant skills. They will drop them out. They won't let them continue. The girls. So look at how the parents are understanding that continuum and okay. What's relevant and what's quality in that continuum.
Thank you. One or two more questions before we go. I think there's one here, the gentleman in the red shirt on this side. Wave your hand. There he is. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation. Having spent time recently in southern Mexico, with all due respect, I mean, if I were to provide some of the recommendations with some of the places that I've been, they kind of look at you kind of dumbstruck in and to a certain extent think it's almost galling and dastardly for you to come in and say that you're working with the government, because they look at you and say, the person before you said that, person before you, him said that as well. And there's this kind of anxiety and this this kind of disenfranchisement. What would you say to somebody like me? I'm a graduate student at the University of Cambridge. I do a lot of kind of projects outside. What do you say to people that my age that are going on projects and want to provide people with hope and kind of excitement that things will change, but then are kind of struck by the question of the government hasn't done anything for us, and you keep talking about the government. Are there kind of things that you can provide us or kind of trenchant examples that we can provide them? Thank you.
Thank you. Very good question. One last question here. Well, we'll do these two right here, the white and the blue. Yeah.
We often hear that evidence of good results, monitoring and evaluation is critical for the interventions. And, of course, donors always look for good evidence. My question to, I think, Dipali directly is, how can we ensure that funding really gets to agencies that are producing some results? It's often in this global environment where funding is scarce at times. How can we ensure that we fund and secure funds for these kinds of activities? And what is transpiring? What are your thoughts about that?
Last question right here. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for your work on this. I just wanted to ask very briefly for everyone's thoughts on the most important ways that ICT can be used to improve the quality of learning and also to impact the training of teachers.
So why don't you, we don't have a ton of time, so why don't each of you tackle one question and we'll see if we can cover them all. Ole, do you have a thought of what, maybe we'll start with you this time?
I'll touch on the idea of the last question on ICT and quality of learning. For us in working and focusing on in Africa, I think it's something that's pertinent. It's something we need to start looking at. Work has already started on that. At FAWE, that's one area we want to start looking at. How do we get teachers and young girls in particular to be part of that e-learning system, to be part of this globalized world. We are very restricted with bandwidth, with energy issues, and because of the location and the rural areas where these young girls come from and who we actually target, this is a challenge. But I mentioned this morning that one area we want to look at is use of mobile phones, because these are easily, you can easily charge them. Everybody seems to have access to it. The youths seem intrigued with the use of mobile phones, using these online service providers, Facebook, Twitters. How can we use these for us as platforms, linking them to mobile phones for learning? Because sometimes we have these hard-to-reach children who cannot get access to the part of this globalized world. So this is something that FAWE plans to look into. Thank you.
And probably we can talk later about this, but we have two innovative programs, one in Tanzania where we're linking up the secondary school teachers with e-based learning. So I'll be happy to share that program that we're developing. And the other one is, of course, with the GSMA fund, which is around m-learning. I'm sure you must be aware that Nokia has given a huge grant to UNESCO as well, which is looking at this whole m-learning piece, so around the lines that you're talking about. So things are happening, but I think we need to be sharing and learning from each other. Going back to your question, I think, again, from a foundation perspective, when it comes to results, we're really looking at what does success look like? You know, what's the kind of impact that we want to achieve? Starting from the young person. So what's the difference that we're going to make in the life of that young person? Then going to the community, looking at the institutions, the systemic changes that are needed. So we're also mindful from a foundation perspective in terms of what's really realistic. We're looking at cost effectiveness, we're looking at efficiency, we're looking at sustainability, we're looking at scalability, and I think these are things that all of you have been hearing. But really, understanding the theory of change and really seeing, you know, what is it that we really want to see different? What's really going to be making that real transformational impact on that life of that young person? I guess we're also looking at the risks associated with it, because we do know, you know, and we do want to be a learning organization. So even if there's failure, you know, we've taken some risks. We started out with good intentions, but, you know, we didn't succeed. We want to talk about it. So we're not shying away, at least. And I think many foundations share the same values that I'm talking about. So I guess it's difficult to answer your question, and it's always interesting with every new partnership that you're developing, because, you know, you really want to kind of understand where the partners are coming from and how can you work together to really make sure that at the end of the day, you are really delivering on what is being promised on both sides.
One quick thing on technology, which isn't in the e-learning side, but the potential use of technology, certainly cell phones for example, paying teachers. Particularly useful, for example, for teachers in rural areas, assuming you have the teachers in the rural areas, who even the best teachers often have to leave for several days to be able to come to the capital or wherever to get paid. So the technology use, not only in the learning part, but one of the hardest, one comment to the gentleman in the red shirt, one of the hardest parts of being involved in development is that the hardest part is building trust. And that's what takes the time. You can have all the greatest programs, but if there isn't trust, and that takes a little longer. Monitoring evaluation, I mean, you know, since I'm now going to talk in code terms again, but since Paris and Accra, which is, I love the way we always talk about where meetings were held, and we all know what it means, but yeah, other people think nice things about Paris. But since, you know, there's been a big buildup in the development field over the last couple of years around the issue of results, not just input, but output. What is the impact? And kind of a huge kind of machinery buildup around talking about and supposedly thinking about results, but not much assistance to the places where the results have to show. And so so I share the concern that that it's not very sexy to put financing into monitoring and evaluation. And so you've got to, and furthermore, very often finding the critical skills capacity in the monitoring and evaluation area is a challenge as well. It's not, you know, you don't go home at night and say, guess what I do, Mom? I do monitoring and evaluation. It's nicer to say I save lives or I teach kids or something like that. So it is an area that there has to be more credibility in, we have to put more attention to, and we have to be prepared to finance more. And we're doing it, we being the broader we are doing it more, but it is critical if we are to make data-driven decisions, and we have to do more of that in development, is make decisions based on good information.
Jenny, last concluding thought.
Sure. I'll try to tackle May's question. And I appreciate it, again, as someone that's been involved with the development of this report, prioritizing versus focusing on the continuum of education. For those of you who might remember seeing earlier drafts, we had this crazy visual of all the different components and aspects that were needed and different layers and different names for all of them. And I think, as you rightly said, May, in order to be effective, we have to have a manageable list that we can come together and agree on. That being said, I think what we tried to do is strike a balance, recognizing while we have these key priorities and related strategies and actions, that they actually do fall within this continuum. So the first one does look at early childhood development, starting in the womb. Then we go on to literacy and numeracy, focusing a lot into lower primary. And then looking at post-primary, which requires the completion of good quality primary school. But then we also took it further to talk about the transition from school to work and school to higher learning. So that's not to claim that we tried to do everything, but I think we tried to, in some ways, walk that fine line between recognizing, as you rightly say, education is a continuum and there's a whole spectrum to address, while also wanting to be as effective as possible and have a manageable list that we could all come together and work around.
Great. Well, excuse me, we're out of time. Thank you to the panelists, and thank you to all of you for your attention.